Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call to order the House Veterans Committee for February 8th, 2011. And we are going to have a series of public hearings today. House Bills 2406, 2407, 2578. And with that, I would like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2406. And would the administrator please give us a background on the bill?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is this bill establishes a telephone line for victims of military sexual trauma. It's got an emergency clause, and its subsequent referral is to Ways and Means.
Okay, thank you very much. And with that, I have two members of the body here who are on tight schedules. So Representative Cowan and Senator Mona Sanderson, if the two of you would please come forward. And I would first ask that Representative Cowan perhaps give us a little background, because I believe that this bill came from her interim committee when she was chair. So with that, turn it over to you. Thank you very much, both of you, for being here today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Jean Cowan. I represent House District 10 and did, in fact, chair the Veterans and Emergency Services Committee during 2009 and the interim committee. So I just wanted to briefly introduce the two of the bills that you're going to hear today as having been products of the task forces that we assigned in 2009 and who worked very hard through the interim to develop some concrete suggestions for how we could deal with some of the complicated issues that are facing our veterans, and particularly some of our women veterans. Senator Mona Sanderson and I worked together on one of those task forces, and I'm very glad to see her here, because she can explain it in detail for you. And I just simply wanted to mention that several of the bills that will be coming before this committee are ones that are the product of the work of three interim task forces, and people have put a great deal of time and energy in trying to think of creative ways that we can address some of the issues that we face. So thank you for hearing the bills, and I will get back to where I'm supposed to be.
Thank you so very much, and please feel welcome whenever we are hearing a bill that had the genesis in your interim committee to rejoin us if you care to.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Senator Mona Sanderson, welcome.
Thank you, chairs and members of the committee. I'm Senator Mona Sanderson. I'm delighted to be here. I do serve on the Senate Veterans Affairs Veterans and Military Affairs in the Senate. In 2000, and I represent Gresham, Trout, Delwood Village, and Fairview. In 2009, we passed legislation creating the Task Force on Women's Veterans Health Care. Very little attention has actually been placed on women veterans and their unique and challenging needs. This suggestion actually came from a town hall meeting in Salem. A woman was a victim of military sexual trauma, and it became painfully obvious that there was a lot of work to do on women's veterans issues in Oregon. So in October in 2009, we started meeting monthly. And we had a briefing on military sexual trauma, visited the VA's Southern Oregon Rehabilitation Center and clinics in White City, the Roseburg VA Healthcare System, and the Portland VA Medical Center, where we were briefed on specific women veterans programs and plan and plans for future accommodations. And we talked with women who were receiving care in the residential treatment programs and women who used the VA healthcare system, and we also attended the 2010 Oregon Women Veterans Conference, where we also spoke with many women veterans. So the task force actually identified 17 findings, and they made 12 recommendations, and one of them was creates House Bill 2406 and basically creates a 1-800 MST, Military Sexual Trauma Hotline, and Women's Veterans Warm Line. We're not sure exactly if that's going to turn out to be exactly what it is, but there is, we know, a $250,000 appropriation, And I know there isn't funding, but I am hoping the department will be able to find money somewhere. But it certainly, I know, cannot come out of the general fund. There really is a need for a safe, gender-specific care for women's veterans in the state of Oregon. Women veterans feel often stigmatized by military sexual trauma and disabled labels. So professionals in the health and social service fields would really benefit from education on MST and women's veterans. Thank you for letting me testify on 2406. And then just briefly, may I just make comment on House Bill 2407?
Please.
Okay.
I would
temporarily
recess the hearing on House Bill 2406 and open a public hearing on House Bill, 2407?
Yeah. And basically, it was one of the recommendations. One of our recommendations turns into House Bill 2407, and that is also designed, not also, but it is designed to encourage women who are veterans to take advantage of health care benefits.
Senator, yes. Excuse me, I'm sorry, but again, for the public
record. For the record, I'm Senator Lori Moniz Anderson, representing Gresham Troutdillwood Village in Fairview.
Thank you.
Here to testify on House Bill 2407, and I'm not going to go into the genesis of the recommendations, but basically the Women's Health Care Task Force wants 2407 because it is designed to encourage women who are veterans to take advantage of health care benefits provided by the United States Department of Veterans Affairs. Again, this bill asks for appropriation of $100,000. I know this is not the time to be asking for money, but we need to discuss we really need to have the conversation and discuss the inadequacies that our women veterans are experiencing and to really understand the difficulties that they are facing. So I would encourage at least for an active discussion of House Bill 2407. So thank you very much for allowing me to testify.
Thank you very much, Senator Moniz Anderson. We certainly appreciate your support for these bills as well as your appearance. Committee members, is there anyone that has questions for the senator? Because if you do, I'm going to open a hearing on both bills at the same time to accommodate that. If not, we would excuse the senator.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to recess the public hearing on House Bill 2407 and reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2406. Okay, next on our witness list, we have Deborah Zawickenbaum, and we have Nancy Visser, and we have Reverend, I can't read your writing, I'm sorry.
Robert Bates, I graduated from high school.
Okay.
And college, right?
Very good, sir. Would any of you like to come up as a panel? Feel free. If you would like to come up as a panel, that's fine. If you would like to come up independently, that will work as well.
You mentioned your name first, which so I do have some. Yes, that would be great.
Would you hold on just for a minute? Please take a seat. Do you know if he's in a time crunch? Senator Przanski, can you give me a hint as to your what kind of time crunch you're probably under?
I'm fine.
Okay, we'll get you on much sooner than that, much sooner. I just would, if possible, let these two witnesses proceed. Thank you very, very much for appearing today. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
I do have some printed materials.
If you'd please give them to Ms. Scott, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Well, good afternoon, Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Esquivel, and members of the House Veterans Affairs Committee.
My name is Deborah Zwetchgenbaum, and I am the Assistant Director of the Crisis Line Program at Oregon Partnership. And I'm very grateful to have this opportunity to speak today in support of House Bill 2406. Oregon Partnership exists to end substance abuse and suicide. That's our mission statement. And we have been serving the state of Oregon for 18 years. We're a statewide organization, and we've been in the business of doing offering hotlines for all of that time. We run the state's Drug and Alcohol Helpline. That's our oldest line. In 2000, we became the only suicide hotline in the state to earn accreditation from the American Association of Suicidology. And in 2005, we were selected as the Oregon affiliate of the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. 2 years ago, in 2008, we were selected as the Pacific Northwest Regional Backup Center for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. So we know a little bit about hotlines. And the question before us today is, why do we need a specific hotline specifically for people who have experienced military sexual trauma? And before I get too heavily into that, I want to talk a little bit about our programs. Now, I gave you an overview, and I mentioned that we run the state's Drug and Alcohol Helpline, Suicide Prevention Lifeline. We have a Spanish Drug and Alcohol Helpline, a youth line. And then in May of 2010, we launched our dedicated military helpline. And I've been selected to speak with you today because I'm a master's level clinician with extensive experience working with survivors of trauma, and I've been very involved from the very inception of this military helpline. And one of the things that we have learned in doing this military helpline, that it's all about reducing the barriers. It's about removing obstacles to seeking help, okay? And I want to talk a little bit about what our experience has been on the military helpline, and I'm happy to report that we've really been getting some traction in our call volume on that line, and I want to share a little bit of what we've learned. Talking about barriers to help-seeking behavior and stimulating help-seeking behavior. We all know our culture encourages self-reliance, and military culture values very highly self-reliance, strength, pride, stoicism. What we've done in designing our military helpline, we've combined it's a military-civilian collaboration. And we launched it in the spring of 2010, but it was really 2 years in the making, building relationships going across the state, not just sitting in Portland, but really getting out there, meeting people across the state, building connections with all the service providers, creating a resource database. What we want to do is tighten the weave of the safety net. And the problem is that a lot of our veterans, our active duty service members, they're falling through the cracks. And so this is about tightening the weave and creating a safe place for them to call. And what we've learned is that if people are going to call our military helpline, we need to be extremely confidential. We need to be credible. We need to have credibility with folks in our military community. And we need to be competent in meeting their needs. Now,
excuse me, yes. Ms. Zwetchgenbaum,
yes.
And I apologize if I'm butchering.
That was pretty
your name.
Good.
Thank you. Better than the first time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. Did you introduce yourself at the beginning of your testimony?
Yes, she did.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh,
thank you.
You
very much. I apologize for the interruption. Please continue.
Okay.
I think she did better with her last name than I do with mine.
So, yes, I'm Deborah Zwetchgenbaum, and I'm the Assistant Director of the Crisis Line Program at Oregon Partnership, and I've been there for 3 years, and I have 20 years in the field of treatment.
Thank you so much, and I apologize for interrupting your train of thought.
You're very, no problem. So, when we're talking about reaching military personnel, veterans, we're reaching out to veterans of all eras and their families, and the barriers are even higher when the issue is MST. So I want to quote Laurie Daniels. from the Vet Center up at in Portland, the Portland Vet Center. I attended a forum on enhancing MST care for women veterans, and the quote I have is that a person who has experienced MST has been interpersonally traumatized. The client will necessarily be wary of trusting and opening up. The client will repeatedly test to see if the listener can be emotionally present, to bear witness to the intense distress the client feels and offer safe containment. She went on to say that soldiers at war experience their own private hell, but it takes place in a public environment, so there is some shared truth. Soldiers who experience MST experience a private hell in a private environment. No one knows, and the barriers to reporting are extremely high. Often people who have experienced MST have tried to reach out and report that they have been betrayed when they have spoken up. So if we're going to really reach our women veterans, we need to be branding this line and getting it out there. This is for you, okay? And the people who are answering this phone are well-trained to respond to your needs. If we don't get that message out there, then people aren't going to call. And what we've learned in this with our military helpline is that if we do it right, people will call. So Oregon Partnership's innovative model brings together civilians with veterans and active duty military, drawing on the passion of well-trained volunteers under the supervision of master's-level clinicians. As a private nonprofit, we can offer a level of confidentiality that breaks down some key barriers. And the fear of being outed to commanders and colleagues and the desire to distance oneself from painful experiences within the military system sometimes, that a civilian-military collaboration on a hotline, what we found is that can be very effective. So other supporting facts that I want to bring out. One-third of the women coming to the Portland VA screened positive for MST. 16 to 23% of military personnel have experienced MST, according to a study in 2007, and 23 to 29% of all female veterans seeking medical care through the VA report that they have experienced sexual assault. So these are really big numbers.
Yeah, how much was that again, please?
23 to 29% of all female veterans seeking medical care through the VA reported that they had experienced sexual assault. Now, of all the statistics that I found when I was getting ready for today, this was the biggest one. According to a survey by the American Journal of Industrial Medicine, one in three female vets from Vietnam through the first Gulf War said they were raped while serving. Among civilian women, the rate is one in six. Okay, so we're talking about a really huge problem. Am I running out of time? Yes.
You are not personally running out of time. I do know that we have a number of members of the legislative body here who I think are on a shortened time schedule.
Yes.
And I so truly apologize for once again interrupting your testimony on such a critically important issue. But if I would beg your consideration that we would allow the other members of the legislative body to come up, because they are sitting on other committees and are in here to testify on a couple of bills. And I deeply apologize for interrupting you yet once again.
That's okay. I really am very passionate about this topic, and I really appreciate the opportunity to speak to you in support of House Bill 2406. I think it's a very important bill, and our women veterans deserve to have a line that is for them where they can feel comfortable and confident calling.
Thank you. And I don't want you to rush your testimony. I'm going to, if you have time, bring you back.
Okay.
I'm just going to recess this and then come back to you. And my apologies to both of you.
No problem.
I'm going to recess the public hearing on House Bill 2406 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2578. Gentlemen, do you want to appear as a panel or... Okay, so please come forward.
Yes.
Get your chair.
If the committee administrator would please read the what the measure does, please.
House Bill 2578 modifies existing statutory language requiring the Director of the Department of Veterans Affairs to establish a third Oregon Veterans Home in Roseburg, Oregon. This has, it also authorizes the director to seek a federal grant funds to establish the home.
Thank you very much. Welcome, co-speaker Hannah and Representative Freeman. Certainly appreciate your presence here today. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and colleagues. We very much appreciate the opportunity to be in front of you. To our predecessors here at the podium, thank you for your patience. It's hard to interrupt what was important testimony, and thank you, Mr. Chair. To the committee and members, I'm Bruce Hanna, State Representative from House District 7. I am here this afternoon in support of House Bill 2578. This bill completes a process that was started by the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs and establishes a third veterans home in the community of Roseburg. Representative Freeman is here with me today and will talk more about the process that led to the determination that we need additional veterans homes here in Oregon. Today I'm going to talk about the importance of locating the Oregon Veterans Home in close proximity to the Oregon's VA Medical Center, which is currently in Roseburg. Roseburg is home to the Roseburg VA Medical Center. It provides comprehensive care to more than 62,000 veterans who reside in central and southern Oregon. Most of those veterans choose to live in the Roseburg area so they can be treated by the medical facility at the Roseburg VA. The Roseburg VA campus consists of over 200 acres and 32 different health care facilities. It provides veterans with primary health care, surgical care, mental health treatment, and long-term care. In addition to the VA hospital, many other providers located in Douglas County provide specialty health care by agreement for veterans. For the past two decades, as an example, the Community Cancer Center, a freestanding not-for-profit radiation facility, has provided thousands of area residents with care from the VA system. Healthcare providers choose to locate to Roseburg to help meet the needs of local veterans and that veterans community. Over the years, many patients have developed a rapport and a good relationship with the trained medical staff in Roseburg. An Oregon Veterans Home in close proximity to the Roseburg VA Medical Center simply makes sense for Oregon veterans. It allows veterans the opportunity to live close to their medical care. In many cases, it allows veterans to remain in their home community, very much important, close to their friends and family. I very much appreciate the opportunity to testify before you today and urge your support of House Bill 2578. And with that, Representative Freeman is going to give you some background. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Freeman.
Great. Thank you, Chair Witt and Chair Esquivel, for hearing this bill so quickly. And there is some time need to hear this fairly quickly. But real quick, before I get into it, I wanted to thank the work of the Women Veterans Task Force. I was able to attend some of their meetings as I served on this committee last cycle. And they're doing great work, and we'll get through this pretty quick so you can get them back up here. So the brief history on House Bill 2578 and the need for it. So back in 1995, Representative Bill Markham, along with other veteran committee members, passed legislation to allow for a second Oregon State Veterans Home. So this started all in 1995. The Oregon Veterans Department worked with the federal government for all those years to work on an appropriation to get the money together to be able to do this. My understanding is they work very hard on it and have everything in place there. So in 2007, the department came back to the legislature and asked that the needs assessment be removed from the legislation to allow it to accommodate for the veterans home to move forward without going through all the process of a needs assessment, because the federal Veterans Affairs had already done the need assessment for the number of beds needed in Oregon. And that was granted to them in 2007. So then the department started the process of establishing what size home, the model for the home, and where it should be built. They developed a request for proposal for a 300-bed facility and appointed a siting committee. There were numerous committees that submitted proposals. The siting committee went to work, and I'm not going to get too deep into all the work they did, but they spent a ton of time evaluating all these different sites, including visiting all the sites and very much trying to figure out the best way to serve the veteran population here in Oregon. During this process, the siting committee made a decision that it would the best way to serve the veterans in Oregon would be to build two additional homes at 150 beds each instead of one 300-bed home. And the idea of that was that the catchment area and where the veterans lived in Oregon would be better served with two smaller homes rather than the one big home. Now, you can imagine some of us that applied were hoping to have the big 300-bed home, but after sitting with the department and understanding the reasons why they did this, it really makes sense to serve the veterans. The best way is to have two of the smaller homes spread out across the state. So Director Willis, on the recommendation of the siting committee, did award two 150-bed homes, one to be built in Lebanon and one to be built in Roseburg. So the hope from the ones of us that were awarded beds is that the legislation that was passed in 95 and 2007 would allow those two homes to be built because the total number of beds was still just at 300. As it turns out, the legislation that was in place is not going to allow that. They need one more piece of legislation. So the idea of this piece of legislation simply allows them to move forward with what their plans are and all the work they've done and allow the what will be the third veterans home built in Roseburg. So in summary, this bill simply allows the department to build two additional state veterans home, one in Lebanon, one in Roseburg, and it is where the siting committee determined that would best serve the veterans of Oregon. The need to get this done fairly quickly is that there is a additional appropriation adjustment that has to be done through the federal government, and time is sort of the essence to get them working on that, and then the local community will come up with their local match. There is no state dollars in this project. I'd be happy to answer questions. Thank you for allowing me to testify today.
Thank you very, very much. Questions or comments for our distinguished panel? Yes, Representative Boone, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a process question, I guess. Does this bill just pertain, I'm trying to read it here too without glasses, in Roseburg? So if I want one at the coast, I'll have to start over.
Chair Witt, Chair Escoval, Representative Boone, the siting work has already been done. The Veterans Department did evaluate all the applicants and chose Lebanon and Roseburg as the best two places to serve the veterans in Oregon. So this is fulfilling that that bid award that's already been done. That being said, there's a need for about 900 total beds, and we won't even be serving half of the need when these homes are completed. So ample opportunity in the future for communities around Oregon to fill additional needs.
Thank you.
Yes, Co-Chair Esquivel.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. Representatives, I appreciate you bringing this forward. I think it's a step in the right direction, but you are correct. We're a third of the way there, and I would like to see us expand this maybe this coming session and get a bill in to see if we can't do anything in the Klamath Falls and the Medford area, since that's a good tie-in for the VA down there as well in White City.
Mr. Chair, might I comment?
Please.
One of the things that I think, and Representative Esquivel, Co-Chair Esquivel, is that as the siting committee made their visits around the state of Oregon, the one thing that became abundantly clear and I think is unchanged, and specifically in Roseburg, I know, because I made the site evaluation visit when they were there, but all these communities around the state of Oregon are stepping up in a very big way. Representative Freeman mentioned the match. The community match in Roseburg is about $8 million. It's everything from infrastructure development to parks and recreation tie-ins and so forth. I think there are other communities around Oregon who very much see the need, and I think, again, the idea was spreading these out. I'm very familiar with the White City facility of VA. Again, we're just scratching the surface of need. So this committee is going to be busy with this issue, and we're going to be back having this conversation to more fully meet the need of our veterans.
Thank you very much. Additional questions or comments for our panel? Not seeing any. Gentlemen, thank you so very, very much. Certainly appreciate your appearance here today, and certainly appreciate putting the finishing touches on something that Bill Markham, who is a longtime member of this body, started, and I believe, if memory serves me right, I think was a B-17 pilot. So good tribute to a longtime member. Thank you, gentlemen, very, very much. Yeah. I'd like to call up next, please, Senators Prezansky and Cruz. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Co-Chairs, for the record, Prezansky, State Senator, District 4, which includes parts of Lane and Douglas counties. And I'm here also in support of the House Bill 2578. This is a bill that actually will, in fact, allow for the completion of what Bill Markham started, and I'll date myself. I had the opportunity in 1995, my first session, to actually support that legislation. So it's nice to see us as a state being able to move forward. The important parts I want to emphasize is what I think was decided by the siting committee through this process. As Representative Freeman said, it started off with the objective of doing one site for one home for 300 members. What was determined was based on the demographics of the state and those of the most need that would be actually utilizing the facility, it was determined at that time that instead of doing one site at 300, it would be better to do smaller sites at 150. And so the siting committee did, in fact, come back with their recommendations of going to two smaller sites, the Lebanon as well as Roseburg. And in, through this process, as you can imagine, all of us who were had an interest on the Roseburg site were keeping in contact with the Department of Veterans Affairs. And Director Willis ensured us and actually gave us some documentation saying that based on what the siting committee had done, that the third site would, in fact, be the Roseburg site. And I think Representative Co-Speaker Hannah has, in fact, put forth the reasons why the siting committee more than likely came up with that was based on the infrastructure, the facilities that are already in existence, and being able to provide for the ongoing care of these veterans that need to have this type of a residential home, and having all the other needs met by what the community can put forward. And so for myself, as someone who was part of the 1995 legislature, had the opportunity to put in motion looking for that second home, I thought it was important then. I still think it's even now more imperative. I do think it's important, as Co-Chair Esquivel has said, and Representative Boone, that you know we should be looking at how can we serve other areas of veterans. And the demographics clearly will show and demonstrate that there are other areas that for smaller facilities can accommodate and can actually give us a better bang for the buck. The one part that we do need to be working on together as a legislature is making sure this message that we're speaking today gets back to D.C. For those in the federal level as to determining that their involvement and investment in the state of Oregon, we think that it is best to serve our veterans in smaller facilities instead of having large ones that really puts more of a, let's say, hindrance on the family and friends of these honored individuals that would be living in these facilities and making it much easier so they can stay connected to their own communities. With that, Mr. Co-Chairs, I will give Senator Cruz the next opportunity.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Co-Chairs Witt and Esquivel, for the opportunity to testify before you today. For the record, Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1, which is part of the Coastal Caucus, so and
yes.
Actually a third of the Coastal Caucus is here, so we could probably do some business. A couple points that haven't been made that need to, because Roseburg VA has been in the news some lately, and it's federal issues and their attempt to downsize and one thing or another, and I will say that we have very strong commitments at this point in time from Senator Wyden and Congressman DeFazio to make sure that doesn't happen. Clearly, it's this veterans' home is a disconnected issue, but trust me, they are connected. They truly are. So our stepping up, I think gives our congressional delegation a leg up in trying to make the demands of the Veterans Administration to make sure that we stay a fully competent facility in Roseburg. I will say that this does scratch the surface of need, but the need for other homes is clearly evident, but I would suggest, Representatives Boone and Esquivel, that there is another way we can be going here. We are going to be having a big push this session to try to start creating the long-promised community-based mental health system in the state of Oregon. And I just had a conversation with Mr. Willis before we came in here. He's going to be in D.C. in a couple months, and he said he would bring that issue up to the feds to see if they wanted to play in our game. So, because clearly, if they're willing to put some resources in for the community, you know, the 16-bed facilities, and clearly a lot of our veterans, their issues are mental health issues. There's no doubt about that. And so there's a potential for us to be able to serve them in more than one type of setting here. So I think we need to be very cognizant of all of the directions we can go to try to serve our veterans, and we need to be able to look outside of the box to try to get those services there. So that's an agenda we have in the Senate for the community-based mental health system. We're going to be as aggressive as we can in this budget frame to move forward with that. So that's another resource to consider here. But quite honestly, the need is overwhelming for what we're proposing here. And like Representative Freeman said, this is a technical tweak to make sure that we have the authority to do what's already been decided. So I urge you to considerably favor this bill and send it over to us in the Senate soon so that we can get the process in D.C. going.
Thank you very, very much. And we will take heed of the timeline here. I want to thank Representative Esquivel, who, while I was out sick, made sure that we got this into the queue early. So thank you for that. Questions or comments for Senators Cruz or Przanski? I'm not seeing any. Gentlemen, as things progress, if the assistance of this committee would be helpful, please let us know.
Thank you very much.
My sense, Mr. Chair, is that the reception in the Veterans Committee on the Senate side will be very positive.
Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. With that, I am... Do we have additional witnesses for this bill?
I don't believe so, no.
578. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2578 and reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2406. Yes, please come forward. My apologies for the interruption of your testimony. Thank you ever so much for your patience. It's most appreciated.
You're welcome. I put 3 hours in the parking meter, so no problem.
Sure.
Yes, and I just want to thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to speak.
And one more time for the record, if you'd please reintroduce yourself, it would be appreciated. Thank you.
So my name is Deborah Zwetchkenbaum, and I'm the Assistant Director of the Crisis Line Program at Oregon Partnership.
Thank you.
And when I spoke earlier, as I reflected, I thought I did get most of my ideas across, so I just want to give you all the opportunity to ask questions if you had questions about what I had to say, or I could turn over to my colleague here.
Thank you so very much. What I think I'd like to do is hold the questions until, is it Ms. Visser or Visser?
You were correct the first time.
Visser,
right.
Yes. After Ms. Visser has had an opportunity to testify, maybe we can ask questions of both of you at the same time. Please proceed. Welcome.
Thank you, sir, and good afternoon, co-chairs Witt and Esquivel. I hope I've said that correctly.
Close enough.
My name is Nancy Visser, and I am the chairwoman, or at least was the chairwoman, of the Legislative Task Force on Women Veterans Health Care that Senator Montez Anderson and Representative Cowan were members of. And I'm here today to support House Bill 2406, which will create a military sexual trauma hotline in Oregon. And I appreciate your being here as well, as she's also the subject matter expert. She didn't serve on the task force, but I, as part of the advisory committee for the ODVA, I was able to listen to her presentation in Grand Ronde. So I thank her for being here. Our task force spent a great deal of time learning about military sexual trauma and its aftermath. The Army has called MST an epidemic, with 22% of women veterans stating they have experienced MST, and an astounding 55% have experienced severe sexual harassment. I have friends who have been sexually harassed, and I myself was, but was married and a little bit older and able to deal with it. I have a friend who was raped while on active duty, and I know many people who have personally experienced MST. MST is defined as, quote, physical assault of a sexual nature, battery of a sexual nature, or sexual harassment, which is repeated, unsolicited, verbal, or physical contact of a sexual nature, which is threatening in character, that occurred while a veteran was serving on active duty or active duty for training. Both men and women experience military sexual trauma. According to a presentation by Marsha Hall, Ph.D., Women Veterans Coordinator at Roseburg VA Healthcare System, the Portland VA had 856 cases of MST. Roseburg VA had 319 cases, and White City had, the VA had 208 cases during 2009. For a number of reasons, experts believe that the majority of MST cases go unreported by both men and women, and the task force believes that there are hundreds of more men and women in Oregon who have experienced MST. And this was borne out at the Women Veterans Conference, where Dr. Hall and Sonia Fry, who's a licensed clinical social worker, reenacted some situations. And there were women in there who served during World War II and Vietnam, during the Cold War, who had been sexually assaulted and had never spoken about it. And they actually broke down in the privacy of, along with the other women. MST has a severe effect on its victims. Many develop post-traumatic stress disorder. There are also medical consequences such as sleep disturbances, diabetes, chronic pain, gastrointestinal disorders, heart disease, asthma, and other respiratory conditions, cancer, dissociation and memory loss, nonspecific immune system disorders, and more. So House Bill 2406 would create a military sexual trauma hotline. This hotline would be a confidential way for veterans to seek resources to help address the physical, emotional, and mental damage of MST. Task force determined that many victims would not seek help through the VA, at least initially, due to their experience in the military. An MST hotline would allow a victim to contact a trained professional, which you spoke, to seek information in a way that would be supportive and trusting. The task force discussed the cost of such a hotline and at first was not going to submit legislation given the dire budgetary restraints this legislature is under. However, both Representative Jean Cowan and Senator Lori Moniz Anderson, task force members, encouraged us to submit the bill due to the importance of the issue. Unfortunately, I'm here to report today that our nation has a problem with military sexual trauma, as does our state. It is my hope that this body can find a way to help our Oregon veterans who currently suffer in silence and give them a safe, secure voice at the other end of the line that they can reach, not when they're suicidal, but before they get there, and find help at the end of that line. We know that there are not enough military sexual trauma counselors in the state of Oregon, within the VA, and outside the VA, and especially given our remote rural areas where women don't have access, someone to talk to, this would really be a lifesaver in so many ways, and prevent some of the medical issues that I talked about. If somebody can call a hotline and know that they have total confidentiality and they have an experienced person who understands, that will be huge in terms of time and money and services that we need to provide these women in the long run and may very well save lives. So thank you for letting me testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so very, very much for what is very compelling testimony. I certainly appreciate that. The committee members, questions or comments for either one of our witnesses today? I have a couple of questions. On the low side, it appears that one out of every four people receiving care from the Veterans Administration are the victim of sexual trauma. That seems astounding and off the Richter scale to me, quite frankly. Our military personnel put their lives on the line to defend our country. I don't think that there is any citizen in this country that would expect that one out of four people would have the experience that you both have just described. Are you aware of any studies that would be suggestive of steps that need to be taken to diminish what by any measure appears to be an absolutely unacceptable level of sexual attack in our military service?
So, Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Esquivel, my answer to that question is that all the research shows that in order for people to heal from military sexual trauma, what's essential is that the interpersonal bridge be reestablished. So we have interpersonal traumatization, and what happens is, I just want you to imagine for a minute, imagine you got hit by a truck, and under normal circumstances, you get hit by a truck. The first thing you're going to do is you're going to tell your family members. You're going to receive an outpouring of support, and you're going to get sympathy. You're going to get medical attention. You'll probably come through it. You might have some post-traumatic stress disorder as a result. Maybe you'll get some mental health treatment. Now imagine that you get hit by that truck, and you come back to your unit, and people kind of notice that something's wrong. You're hurt, but you get some funny looks. And there's both explicit and implicit messages,
yes,
that you are not to speak, and so about this at all. So what you need to do is buck up and bury it, okay? You've just been hit by a truck, okay? And you're not going to get any medical attention. You're not going to be able to speak about it with anybody. And you bury it. Now, the only way that comes out in all, it stays there, and it comes out in all kinds of physical and mental problems. I mean, I could go on and on. So in order to, the first step is to recreate the interpersonal bridge. And when you talk to people who do successful treatment of MST survivors, it's that there's going to be a lot of testing of the relationship. It's the relationship. It's the safe environment.
Yes. Thank you, Ms. Visser.
Yes, sir. I think I understand your question as far as there are efforts in each of the services to prevent sexual harassment as well as military sexual trauma. And there is an effort, I think, on the part of DOD to establish, in fact, an overall department or within one of the departments to address this. My personal belief is, being a Marine, is we do everything in fire teams, small units, and fire team squads, platoons. And it's the small unit leader that has to be aware, know his people, his or her people, and look out for their welfare. And what happens, though, in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, and you get women, one maybe in a unit, maybe two, depending on the unit, and things happen. I mean, so... And what happens sometimes is there could be a breakdown in leadership or a perception on the part of the individual that he or she can't go to the leadership because of the disruption of unit cohesion. You don't want to be that person that does that. And so there is been implemented now in at least in Iraq, and I know in Afghanistan, when you go in country, you're briefed. Probably prior to deployment, I imagine, you're briefed that if this occurs, you can report it or you cannot report it. You can report it privately without the unit knowing that you're reporting it, but it's a matter of record. And the reason it has to be a matter of record, because so many women, and I'm talking specifically women in our task force, so many women have experienced military sexual trauma, and it's not been documented.
they come home, they have post-traumatic stress disorder, and maybe resulting from MST, maybe resulting from something else, but it hasn't been reported. And when it's not been recorded, then the VA can say, well, there's no proof that this happened. So now there is a way that you can have it actually reported without having your chain of command know that you reported it. That's not a good answer as far as that doesn't solve the problem. The problem is leadership on down and respect for one another. And I wish I had a solution to know that, because even I was married a whole time I was in the Marine Corps, and yet I got sexually harassed by three senior officers and one peer, and I was able to handle it, but I had to actually press charges against one of them, who was subsequently relieved. And I'm a pretty strong personality. I think you take a young woman who is impressionable and idealistic and respects her small unit leader and gets in a situation which is compromising. So I think that it's important that the emphasis come from the top, and I think that this body would really be showing the Oregon veterans that you really care by passing this legislation and establishing this MST hotline.
Thank you very much. An additional question. I'm presuming that if I am a victim of sexual trauma and I make a phone call seeking help, we've potentially reduced one barrier if the person that answers that telephone is of the same sex that I am.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. This kind of mirrors, though, I just came off the Children's Advocacy Board in Southern Oregon, which is we treat sexually abused children. And what's interesting, your statistics mirror what society is doing. And that's pathetic, but it's true. One in four young ladies, by the time they're 21, are usually sexually abused in some manner. But what's also interesting is one in six boys are. So, I mean, that's amazing that one in four came up again.
Yes. So. Representative Parrish.
First of all, thank you for your service.
Oh,
I appreciate it, and I appreciate you being here. Can you share with us, do you have any demographic information on where you're seeing, as people are coming and doing, particularly, you know, when you said that you are having World War II vets and Vietnam vets who are reporting this well after the fact, where you're seeing or are you seeing trends, you know, based on certain conflicts, or are you seeing a lot of new folks from our current conflicts coming in and reporting this? Kind of what does that look like?
Well, I think in the next bill we'll talk about also, I won't bring that, but 24/7 as far as outreach. What I'm finding in my own veterans organizations, like the Women Marines Association, most of the members are World War II veterans who aren't aware of their benefits and aren't aware of even the fact that they maybe were assaulted, that was criminal in some way. They feel sometimes like they're not veterans and that maybe that was my fault. And so that's what I'm finding with the older veterans. For the Marine Corps, we only had 8 officers, I think, and 22 enlisted in Vietnam, in country. So I don't actually know many of them personally. But I do know of women who served during that era. And I think that I don't have, as far as the demographics, I think what we're finding now with 250,000 women now have served since OIF, or Operation Iraqi Freedom and Operation Enduring Freedom, 250,000 as opposed to, you know, maybe 25,000. So you're getting more women, and I would say you're probably having the younger ones. You probably could bear this out, the ones who call on possibly the suicide hotline. But more of them they're filling what used to be non-traditional jobs that for me are traditional jobs, but side by side with men, and whether you're driving a truck or you're flying an aircraft, or now we have female engagement teams in Afghanistan, female Marines who are attached to the infantry. So you're going out for days and you're with them and right alongside them. So I would imagine, unless Tom can back me up with statistics, that you're probably seeing a larger number of younger women in their 20s who are coming back, who are using the VA, and who do report this sexual trauma. But as I mentioned, I was present when women who had served in World War II for the first time spoke up when they saw these reenactments and said, you know, that happened to me, and I've never talked to anybody about it, but I've had, you know, this ailment or that ailment, or, and that's why I said it manifests, if you suppress this, it manifests itself physically, and just like anything else, you really need to reach out to people, to reach out to that voice who can not only talk to you at that time, but also tell you where to go to get help, how to get that help in your community if you're far away from a VA facility or a vet center, or even telemedicine, how periodic phone calls, working through the counseling. People need counseling, just like, you know, rape victims, civilian rape victims, they need counseling right away. So,
thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for your service, too, and for being here and for doing this. It just seems to me that this is a big paradigm shift that needs to come from the top. We've heard, and I've sat on this different permutations of this committee in the past for the last 6 years, and we've heard of women coming forward, and it was their commanding officer who was the abuser. And so how can you possibly report to your commanding officer who is the person who gave you this experience? And I just think it's unacceptable, and I think it should be considered unacceptable. And 250,000 women in the military in this era is significant. And I can't imagine... I just can't imagine having to deal with this on top of all the other traumas of war, and talk about having to be with your, you know, your colleagues and carrying out a mission. I think that would, it's just like child sexual abuse, and you mentioned dissociative behaviors. You can't have those in the war, or at least you can't show that you have them. And that in itself, if someone is having a dissociative event, could become a whole another can of worms as far as problems, not to mention not able to carry out the mission or turning on your colleagues. And, I mean, these are people who are out there doing, protecting us, protecting their group. I don't know what they're called, a troop or whatever, but it just seems to me like that's the kind of, and they're carrying weapons. And I can't imagine that. I don't know what we do to get this to the level where it's considered not just inappropriate, but it's unacceptable, and perpetrators are out. I don't care who they are.
Co-Chair Esquivel, Co-Chair Witt, and Representative Boone, I had one thing I wanted to add, that nationally, the change in the reporting procedures that Nancy mentioned, in December 2010, they reported that there's been a 64% increase in the reporting of MST, which means that we think that means that the new reporting structure where people can report without identifying themselves has made that difference, and the opportunity within the command to address the issue is much bigger as a result of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that happened exactly the same in child abuse reporting over the years, and people thought it was an increase in the events, but it's really an increase in people coming to be able to report it with impunity.
I think I had my first sexual harassment counseling. Everybody had to have it in the Marine Corps, and it was green light, yellow light, red light. So they would try to teach everyone, men and women, okay, this is green light, this is behavior, this is okay. Yellow light,
cautionary. You know, somebody does this, you give them a warning, and you say, that's not okay, back off, which is what I had to do one time. And then there's the red light, which is really what we're talking about in military sexual trauma. You hope that it doesn't get that far, but, you know, this is wrong. But this was back in the mid-90s. It's been emphasized, but we haven't had so many women serving in the combat arena until now. And I'm really glad that the spotlight is finally on it.
The spotlight is appropriately on it because folks like yourselves come forward to make known something I'm concerned has been in the background. And like Representative Boone, I am shocked by the numbers that you've given us here today. And on that basis, I would ask that if either our veterans or military departments are aware of any programs and studies that first take a look at what the problems are here, and secondly, how they're being addressed so that we can bring this level down to zero. I would be most interested in this because these are exceedingly troubling figures that you brought forward here today. Exceedingly. We cannot tolerate attacks on a fourth of our women in combat service. We cannot tolerate the potential of chasing half of our population out of the military service. And I'm very concerned that the figures that you have brought forward here today are suggestive of that. And I by no means want to suggest that that's a problem here in Oregon over and above anywhere we would find throughout general military service. But I am concerned that this is a major problem and needs to be addressed, and I want to see what we're doing.
Chair.
Yes, Co-Chair Esquivel.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, what gets me to thinking about this situation is, what is the real percentage? That's what's troubling to me.
Yeah, it's much higher. It's much, much higher.
Much higher.
Yeah.
Thank you for driving that point home, Co-Chair Esquivel. Yes, Representative Matthews, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you both for your testimony. And I guess, for me, the numbers are astounding, and knowing that we don't know the real numbers, that's scary as well. Being a veteran, I'm almost somewhat embarrassed that the numbers are where they're at, and that's unfortunate. I just want to say that it sounds like we were pretty close to not even being able to hear about this because of the task force, maybe the recommendation, thinking there's no money, you know, in the budget. And I see a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, but my point on this is I sure hope that anybody out there that's committed to serving our veterans on these task force committees and bringing these forward don't use money as a convenient excuse for us not to identify and deal with the problem. This is a big issue. This is a huge issue to all veterans. We're trying to encourage veterans to come to Oregon. We want to send a strong message. So I don't have all the magic answers. I don't have an eight ball, and I can't tell you where the money's coming from. But I will say, for those of us on the dais, to put it in perspective, I look at, amongst the two bills, $250,000 or $350,000 that takes care of that. We're spending double that on house races in this state right now. That's pretty ridiculous. So we need to get ourselves in perspective and go after the big issues, serve Oregonians well, and get the veterans issues taken care of. And again, thanks so much for your time, and apologize for that interruption, but you did a wonderful job today. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Final questions or comments? Again, I think you've heard loudly and clearly that this committee is in your debt for bringing this forward. Thank you very, very much for what, as I said earlier, is exceedingly compelling testimony. Thank you.
Thank you.
At this point, I'd like to call up, please, Reverend Robert Biggs. Cynthia, can you?
Other things. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen.
Good afternoon, sir. Welcome.
I am very happy to have some comments today for you. Being a man of the cloth, I pray for your service and what you're doing. And on this issue that we address today is a veteran issue, of course, regarding women.
Mr. Biggs, before you proceed, would you please introduce yourself for the record?
Ready to do that.
Thank you, sir.
And that is exactly the kind of things that we are doing in the Oregon State Grange Veterans Committee. Please hear that one, because you're going to hear a lot from us. We went through a number of years, as some of you have done, even on the bills we talked about today, to get them up here and get work done on them. We always, many of us who've been Grange members, I myself am 81, and I've been a Grange member since I was 14, and we know what great things that the Grange can do. We've always wanted in the later years to get something on veterans and involved in a Grange, because every Grange has veterans.
Mr. Biggs, with 81 years old, and your name is, and you're from where?
I'm from Salem, Oregon.
I'm just asking that for the record, sir.
Right,
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. I'll get this straight when I go down the line following this bill and have to talk again, maybe. All right. And we put together this committee because we want every Grange to have a veteran to represent the members that are in their communities, whether it's Klamath Falls or Newport or over in Eastern Oregon or wherever it might be, because that comes in close to what we need to do in getting the word out. I heard about that today. We heard about that today. And I want to tell you, our Grange members can be and are motivated to do something now that we're in the middle of the horrible problems we have in Oregon and we have in across the country. And so I am happy to say that our committee is working very, very busily already, and has been for more than 3 years now, on these kind of veterans issues. As far as this particular bill is concerned, my sister was in the Air Force. She was abused. I was shocked. I was in the military at the time, and I got the report from her, and I didn't know what to do except tell the commanding officer. Well, she said, it is the commanding officer that's involved. Well, that horrified me. And so it all comes back in my mind now from the testimony I heard today from that dear Marine lady and the other lady, and what she said. It makes me very, very concerned that we certainly need to do something about it and set up a structure that new good people can work on that. I wanted to say that on the hotline, I feel that that is needed to be done, because the confidence situation is a real problem. I speak about a lady that I've been working with who is with the Marine Corps back in the last of skirmish we had. And she told me the problems she had as a corpsman, as working in the medical field, what she had with abuse. In fact, to the point to where she was afraid to come to the Veterans Center in Portland to have treatment. And she picked me out. She heard about Reverend Bob Biggs. And she'd had an old chaplain that helped her buy a car when she got out of the service. And she became friends with him and helped her on some of her mental problems and so forth. And she got moved around to where she now is feeling that she can have some treatment. And I've directed her to the right people that can help her. That's only one of several. And I don't have time, and you don't need to hear about them. But the cases are all quite parallel. And it reminds me now that we're out in the field getting information. They're able to call us, to write us, to bring it to our attention, and we network out and get something done. And this particular legislation now is certainly going to do a great thing. And I trust that we can all consider it very seriously. Financially, we know the problems of the economy. I can't be this old and not know what the problems are with 14 grandchildren, all the economic things. I thank you so very much for your time, and is there any questions, please?
Sir, the first question, I'm going to try this a different way. Would you please, for the record, give us your name?
Robert F. Biggs, B-I-G-G-S.
Thank you very much, sir.
Retired military and retired chaplain.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your service and appreciate your patience here today in waiting for your turn to testify. Questions or comments for Mr. Biggs from the committee, please? Sir, I'm seeing none. Thank you very, very much. We're going to see what we can do to make sure what happened to your sister does not continue to happen.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, sir.
God bless all, and
thank you, sir.
We'll be watching.
And God bless you, too. And with that, I am reminded that there are a number of us that face a number of challenges, and it would be my request on behalf of the committee that this room in the future be ADA compliant, our setup. So if our committee administrators could make sure that this room is accessible to many of our aging veterans, it would be helpful. Thank you. Are there any other witnesses that would wish to appear on House Bill 2406 at this point? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2406 and reopen the public hearing on, let's see, first of all, do we have any additional witnesses for that bill?
On 2406, no.
2407.
2407.
Yes, we do. I'm going to reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2407. Please come forward. Welcome back, and again, if you would please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, sir. My name is Nancy Visser, and I am the chairwoman of the Legislative Task Force on Women Veterans Health Care. And good afternoon. I want to apologize for being too close to the mic. I just read the instructions afterwards.
Thank you.
So I'm here today to support House Bill 2407, which would direct the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs to implement a women veterans outreach program. During the work of our task force, we learned that Oregon has a little more than 25,000 women veterans, but only about 7,000 use VA services. We further learned that many women veterans do not identify themselves as veterans. I first kind of scoffed at this, I must admit, because I've always been proud of my service, and I couldn't imagine that somebody wouldn't proclaim that they were a veteran, but I learned that it's true. There are many reasons, but and I've listed a couple. Some of them were told they weren't veterans when they left the service. They did not serve in combat, so they did not see themselves as veterans. Their experience in the military may have had an effect on them that makes them not want to identify themselves as veterans, and there are other reasons. The task force believes it is vital that Oregon women veterans receive the benefits they earned through their honorable service. I know that ODVA feels the same way. But to provide these benefits, we first have to reach these women. As we have previously said, up until Operation Iraqi Freedom and Operation Enduring Freedom, the VA has been a male-centric system, primarily because the overwhelming majority of patients have been male. However, OIF and OEF changed that paradigm. In Vietnam, 7,500 women served in country, mostly as nurses, and mostly the Army and
and Air Force, and I could just the gentleman before, if it's a corpsman, it has to be a Navy, so she was a Navy corpsman, whom we consider honorary Marines because they save our lives. In Iraq and Afghanistan, more than 250,000 women have served, and that number grows daily. Women are facing combat right next to their male counterparts as combat medics, corpsmen, military police, truck drivers, female engagement team members, and others. VA's world is changing, and I am happy to report that VA is responding to the challenge by implementing women veterans clinics with gender-specific and appropriate care. A large number of Afghanistan and Iraqi women veterans are using the VA. Older veterans are not. The task force wants to reach all women veterans and educate them regarding the changes at VA and why women veterans now are more welcome than perhaps they were in the past. House Bill 2407 has a small fiscal impact. The task force did not want to recommend that you mandate that ODVA do this outreach without at least some resource to help the agency in the effort. So I know you'll agree with me that reaching Oregon's women veterans is important, and I encourage you to support House Bill 2407 so that we can proactively reach out and provide these honorable women the benefits they earned. My point of view is they paid up front with their service and sacrifice. So this bill and the previous bill have already been paid for in service. Thank you for your consideration, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Again, thank you. Questions for Ms. Visser? Yes, Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to be hearing or having a meeting with someone who's looking at enhancing the 211 dialing service and wondering if the veterans could benefit from being on that list. And I see Tom nodding in the back. So
any outreach, I think ODVA has already done a great job, and I can say that even before I was on the advisory council, of getting the question put on your heating bill and other places. You know, are you a veteran? The veterans' license plates. There are so many ways. The Vets News that Tom Mann so ably edits and produces. So ODVA is been doing a great outreach, but with this bill passage, they could do even more. And it's been my personal experience. There are people who attend women veterans conferences. There are women who are members of all of the veterans groups, the Army and the Air Force Association, AUSA, and others, but they're really a small number. The majority who have served are not members of those organizations, and we need to reach them and let them know that they have these benefits and what all the resources that are available to them.
Just a clarification for anybody who doesn't know, 211 is like 911, but not emergency, and it's for Health and Human Services information and resources.
That's right. So. We have too many homeless women veterans, and of course male veterans as well, and women who need help not only because of military sexual trauma, but some who've lost their jobs. Mm-hmm. They need to know where to go, how to get help, and just to let them know that there's a non-disability related pension that you can get. And I'm helping my own women Marines in my chapter. Most of them, again, are World War II, and one who, 87, just had quadruple bypass surgery. She had a heart attack, and she called me the other day, and I met her up at the hospital and gave her daughter the forms because she doesn't think she's going to be able to afford to stay in her house, and also, you know, so, and they had no idea, because these are the ones, some of the ones who don't think that they're veterans, so.
Okay. Additional questions or comments? Ms. Bissner, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Biggs, did you want to come back up for this bill too, sir? You don't have to if you don't want to. I know you were signed up for this one.
I think that I have adequately covered what I have to say, that I'm on our committee.
we are certainly behind what this lady is saying.
Thank you very, very much, sir, and certainly appreciate once again your presence here and support for both of these bills. Is there any other member of the public that wishes to testify today on House Bill 2407? Going once, twice, three times, seeing no one, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2407. Is there any additional member of the public at this time who wishes to testify on House Bill 2578? We heard from a members of the body. I see Director Willis is raising his hand. I'm going to reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2578. Welcome, sir.
Thank you, Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Escoval, members of the committee. I will be brief. I do support House Bill 2578, and I want to speak about that in terms of operational planning. I consider this an operational need within our state for the reasons stated earlier in terms of the lack of numbers of beds.
Jim, would you please remind us who you are?
Oh, I'm Jim Willis. I'm Director of Veterans Affairs for the state of Oregon.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much. I'm quite excited about being up here. But in any event, one of the things I want to ensure, make sure the committee understands is that very early in this session I met with Representative Garrard and Senator Whitsitt. And between them and a couple of other interested members, they are crafting a bill directing the department to conduct in the interim, or from the time that bill passes, which I hope it will, to conduct a study to determine where are our veterans who are qualified for skilled nursing, Alzheimer, or other dementia located that are being underserved. And also, what kinds of facilities could we use in the future in our state that are not the traditional kinds of veterans' homes? The other thing that's tied to this, and somebody mentioned going back to Washington, D.C., and yes, I am in March to meet with the Secretary of Veterans Affairs. The trend is this, and I think the body here knows that we go toward community-based care in smaller size facilities and also look at how much in-home care can we give so that the senior veteran, man or woman, could stay in their home environment longer than they currently are able to and do it affordably. These are things that the federal VA can help us with in terms of their policy decisions going into the future, and this will also help us in doing the planning in our state strategically for what needs to happen in South Central Oregon, what needs to happen in Eastern Oregon, and so on with regard to those needs, and then the shared facilities that we can share across close borders. As an example, from our Baker City, LeGrand, Ontario side, can we share with Idaho? Is that possible? And in some cases, it certainly is. But we've not talked about that in terms of long-term care, whereas we do have an agreement with the state of Washington that allows us to share across the Columbia River. So we have some Oregon people going to the home in Olympia. We have some Washington people coming to the home in the Dalles.
Uh-huh.
It's just cost-effective. It makes sense. It works for the families. And we could do the same thing. As an example, if we had one in Southern Oregon, we could work out an MOU with the California Department of Veterans Affairs and bring those veterans up from California that may not be served by a home close enough to get to them. Maybe they'd have to go all the way to Napa, and that's a pretty long haul from Northern California. So I think with making this report to the legislative body, the House and the Senate, we're going to identify who's being underserved and what types of facilities might we use in the future, and then also be able to report on how the Secretary of Veterans Affairs is reacting to not only what we're saying here in Oregon, but also to what my fellow directors are saying around the nation, because we're going to be meeting in March to discuss these same kinds of issues. So these are not unique to Oregon. The good news is we're moving forward, but I still marvel at my friend, the director in Maine, when I look at his 6 veterans' home in a state that fits inside Harney County. So we need to get this work done, and that's why I'm here to testify in favor of the bill, but also to assure the body we're going to look at different methodologies for the future. and make sure we have the best in care, that it's cost-effective, but more importantly, that it meets the regional needs of the state so that we don't get this east side-west side confrontation or the 97 corridor issues and so on. I'm a native of this state. I'm very aware of how people feel when I travel around. And so when I'm in the far eastern part of this state, I generally tell them I'm from Albany because I am. Because you don't want to say you're from Salem or Portland. But in any event, we've got strong support for this issue on our senior veterans all over the state. That's not the issue. The issue is the how are we going to do it, what's the long term, and if we're there, are we going to stay with that community for a long time like we have with the Dalles? We've been there since 97. We're going to be there for a long time. Same thing in Lebanon, Roseburg, and the other places that we're going to have to serve in the future. So with that, Mr. Chair, or co-chairs, Mr. Esquivel and Mr. Witt, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments for Director Willis? Yes, Representative Parrish, please.
Thank you for being here. Can you just share with us the kind of some of the economic impacts that I think would benefit our community if we were able to move this forward? I know, you know, states that have big bases have really strong lobby for a reason. So can you share with us what this would do for Roseburg?
Well, Co-Chair Witt and Co-Chair Esquivel and Representative or Co-Vice Chair Parrish. Well, that's why we've established, as you've heard, as part of our reintegration team, this concept called Fort Oregon, because we don't have the military bases. And what it does is it brings together everybody who has a common interest in not only our guard forces and our active duty or our active reserve forces, but also our veterans. So we've been very effective at bringing that together. So when you stand up a facility like a veterans home, and I'll use the existing one as an example, you're creating, in that case, about 230 full-time jobs that have been in that community since 1997 in the Dalles and Wasco County. It impacts Hood River and other smaller communities all around that county. So it creates a way for them to weather the really tough economic times with dependable jobs. That same thing will happen in Linn County. It will impact Lane County, and it will impact, to some extent, Marion and the Central Coastal Counties in terms of job opportunities for people there. Also, you may be aware there is a new medical school being built in Lebanon. And, of course, it'll give those young doctors, or interns, if you will, a chance to do the intern work right at the veterans home. So it's a win-win for both the med school and for us. Just as the physicians that are already stationed at the Roseburg Hospital would provide some services for our veterans home, and it's a win-win for the vets that are enrolled there because they've already got staff, they've got x-ray, they've got the ability to do the necessary testing, and especially for seniors. So it's a long-term investment. We don't leave. When we arrive, we stay, and we continue to employ from the local economy.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Representative Parrish, thank you very much for making that very important point. Additional questions or comments? Jim, thank you very, very much.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, all of you.
Anyone from the public who wishes to testify on this point at this point on House Bill 2578? I'm not seeing anyone. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2578. Committee members, is there anything for the good of the order at this point? Vice Chair, excuse me, Co-Chair Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to get a fiscal on 2406-07 and 2578. And maybe we can work those bills next time to get them expedited to the Senate. The House floor and then to the Senate.
Thank you, Co-Chair. I was just going to say myself that it has every appearance that these bills necessitate a fast track, and you and I can get together and try and accommodate that. Anything else for the good of the order? Seeing none. With that, we stand adjourned. I want to thank everyone very, very much for their attendance today.
Good job, Brad.